writing as a spiritual practice? I really never thought of my writing as a spiritual practice until Glenn spoke to me about this service. Frankly, if I had thought about spiritual practices at all, it was in the context of a brainless activity where one could become immersed in a mundane physical act, leaving the mind open to the cosmos. Had I been asked about my spiritual practice, I would have said, washing and waxing my car. That answered the definition. I sort of go into automatic when I do this. It's really a mostly mindless activity, but during the process, my mind is somewhat open. I think that even might be a reasonable definition of spiritual. It is very satisfying once completed. Anticipating your question, the answer is no. Washing and waxing a car is only spiritual if it is my car. I appreciate what might be limitless offers to nourish my spirituality by washing your car. Thanks for your generosity and support of my metaphysical well-being, but no. It doesn't work that way. I would suggest a nearby Hutch's car detailing just down the road between A and B streets. Perhaps you might even achieve spiritual nirvana watching them detail your car. Sometimes, while engaged in this activity, I get the germ of an idea, which will later become something to write about. So maybe there is a nexus from car washing to writing and on to spiritual practice after all. Of course, my thinking that in order to be a spiritual practice, it must leave the mind blank for incoming meaningful revelations goes out the window when it comes to the creative process of putting words on paper. By its very nature, writing requires some degree of overt thought process. While it may be true that given an infinite number of monkeys and an infinite number of typewriters, sooner or later the great American novel will be written, the simple fact is that it hasn't yet occurred, and I really doubt that it ever will. No, writing does require some intent, and while that is happening, it is difficult for extraneous thoughts to enter. But I must add that if the act of writing's goal for me is to put words together in a fashion that they may make some sense, just as waxing my car is to achieve a goal, a clean car, the spiritual aspect is a bonus. I would not write, nor would I take the time and effort to clean my car to experience some cosmic gratification. For me, the anticipated narcotic effect of either of these activities simply makes the doing more pleasurable. Before I go further, I must acknowledge that a lot of the people here today have patiently and graciously listened to some of the audible versions of some of my writings. The word spiritual, as I use it today, is meant to refer to the process, not the outcome. I think it would be stretching credibility to attribute the word spiritual to my finished product. Not even in my deepest periods of egocentricity could I honestly bestow the word spiritual to my writings, but I suppose it depends on how one wants to define the word. So first there is the germ of an idea. Mostly it comes from within, often while doing that other activity of washing my car. But sometimes it is to fulfill an assignment. Today's general theme was from Glenn's brain. The execution and interpretation of that charge rests with the individual, as you'll discern from the three other of us who will speak today. As to the actual process, once in the writing zone, my usual procedure is to go nonstop. I've been known to begin at 5 a.m. and not pause for food, drink, or anything beyond calls of nature, and even those often seem intrusive interruptions. Once complete, and after a break of a day or two, I look at what I've written, and I edit, and I edit, and I re-edit again, until it is as good as I can make it. Only then am I satisfied, and even then, not always. Finally, I share the results. I relish the feedback. That feedback may sometimes be positive, often negative. I need to hear it, but only firsthand. Tell me it was brilliant. Tell me it was dreadful, but tell it to me, not to somebody else. As my friend Brian once said to me, if you don't tick off at least one person, you've failed. Well, I think I've overstepped my allotted time today, and I don't want to tick off the three other participants, nor do I wish to be responsible for delaying coffee hour. In closing, I wish to reassure both the spiritual Dalai Lama and the brilliant writer William Shakespeare. Don't fret, my friends. Neither my spirituality nor my writing skills will even in the slightest budge either of your places in history.
Michael. I'm Mike Noel. I want to thank the church for welcoming me to this congregation. I live really close by. If you've talked to me, I probably told you that I come from a large family. My mother was one of 17. So when we have a reunion, it's this many people. We have a softball game. Writing for me, when I was a youngster, I had a speech impediment, and which was people would help me by telling me, hey, you have a speech impediment, which increased my anxiety. So this story I'm going to read to you was an attempt to get the words out, and it didn't really happen, but it could have. I'm not sure what old man McCarthy would grind a road right behind my grandfather's barn, then laying a PC pipe to the lake, but there it was, and on my grandfather's property line. It was slightly nuts, a provocation or something. We sat around the huge old table discussing it over the card game. All my uncles were there, and everyone was upset or angry or amazed or a weird combination of all three. Except for me, of course. Because I was just a teenager, and I really didn't quite see or feel what the big deal was. It wasn't like Grandpa that used the field behind the barn every day. McCarthy had been a neighbor since the beginning of known time, and the important events like Victoria Trattanini and her piles of curly red hair and brown eyes, that's what was on my mind. My grandfather said he could hire a lawyer or something, then maybe he could go talk to McCarthy or something. Odd verbal habit of ending sentences with a floating something, as in I have to get the car out of the garage or something. It was sort of a weird and annoying verbal tic, but everybody else had gotten used to it years ago except for me. But I was able to concentrate on other important things. Victoria Tarantino was in my English class, and we were planning on working together on the film review of Hiroshima Mon Amour, which is all about, if you don't know, two very different lovers, one French, one Japanese, who meet in Japan and fall in love, all the while scenes of the ruins of collapsed buildings of Hiroshima are edited in the sweeping collage of the background of the film. My Aunt Jean came in and thrust her six-month-old baby into my lap. Hold your cousin for a moment, she said. I have to run back and get the diaper bag out of the Buick. I'll be right back. I looked at little Jennifer for a moment and squirmed into a more comfortable position. In the hard oak chair, I held her hand with my left and tried to drink my apple juice. And with my right hand, Jennifer smiled and reached her hand up to my face. She had a bright, smiling look and looked at me as if I was the most interesting person on the planet. And after a minute, I realized why Jennifer needed a diaper change. She had a load in her diapers, and she smiled gleefully with her efforts. Someone handed me Jennifer's bottle, and she began sucking on it, looking at me as if I was Columbus approaching the coast of a new world. She sucked consistently with great glee until her bottle made a slurping sound. I put the bottle on my table, then had another long slurp of apple juice. Well, you look natural with your little cousin, one of my uncles said. It's good practice, my father said, what she said about most everything I did. painting the back wall, clearing out the garage, or anything kind of annoying. I think you should just go shoot out McCarthy's tires, one of my uncles said. Use your deer rifle. Grandfather ran his hand over his bald head and liked Toshiro Mifune and Seven Samurai. He said, that old iron hasn't been used for 6 deer seasons. It'd blow off a finger or something. He rubbed his head again with indecision. He glanced over at his bookcase. I followed his glaze. He had the books that my uncles brought back from their occupation of Okinawa. Pictures of the Hiroshima bombing. Handbook of Japanese phrases. What had fascinated me when I was a few years younger was the source of my fascination of all things Japanese, and the beginning of my obsession with Japanese cinema. I could tell you anything and more about what director Kurosawa, the famous Japanese existential new wave cinema, more than you want to know. Aunt Jean came in to retrieve her daughter and said, okay, in a moment of soft thanks, I looked down at my Levi's. And there was a stain, of course. I've been peed on. I looked away quickly, afraid she would ask me to change Jennifer's diapers. I took another gulp of apple juice. What are you drinking? That's hard cider. How much did you drink? My Uncle Ray asked, louder than necessary. Suddenly I felt I was going to lose it all right in the middle of the card game. I turned to my left off the table. As I did so, my head swam. My eyes went out of focus. Suddenly I was feeling like I was out of my body and floating above the dining room table. There he was with the entire family, sort of like Yukio Shimura here in Hiroshima Mon Amour, where he was rolling on the unmade sheets with Isabel Hubert, one of my favorite scenes from the film. I could hear my grandmother speaking to her oldest daughters in the kitchen, and in my altered state it sounded like birds chirping. Qu'est-ce que c'est, she said. The bird sound floated into me, and I floated. Then I sank back to my place at the table and ran my hands over my face. I wanted to tell everybody what happened, but I didn't know how to describe it. So I just sat there, stomach churning, head swirling, looking at my cards, reaching for another glass of Applejack that someone had carelessly poured for me. My grandmother came in with a plate full of turkey sandwiches. I think we should ask a blessing before lunch, she announced. McCarthy has been our neighbor since we bought this place. She placed the pile of sandwiches in front of us that reached almost to the middle height of my chest. He's a member of St. Leo's, our church. Maybe we should just pray for McCarthy, I suggested, with a slight sardonic intent. But it seemed like to be something my grandmother would appreciate. Granddad immediately jumped on the suggestion, which surprised me a little, since he wasn't known for his religious sensitivities. But for some reason, I felt like he wanted to make Grandma happy. She brushed the gray hair out of her face. Let's pray something good comes to him, Old McCarthy, she said in a clear, strong voice. I think of myself as religious as a next Unitarian, but I didn't recall ever closing my eyes during a prayer. I kept my eyes open slightly. I kept both eyes in the sandwich pile, just in case anyone grabbed a roast beef sandwich before their turn. But in the mood of the moment, like Toshiro Mifune, when he realized he was accepted by the fellow samurai, I prayed that McCarthy would have something to happen in his life that made him feel happy, distracting him from planting crops right on my grandfather's property line, anything. We finished a few more hands of cards. I stopped drinking Applejack and went back to apple juice. My stomach settled down a little, my eyes back in focus. I could see the card faces again. I stuffed myself with two large sandwiches. The family came to no decision. No one went over to talk to McCarthy. File a lawsuit or shoot out his tires. The Reno Lakes did as water level as water flowed and waters McCarthy's new field of corn, squash, and green beans. 2 months later, McCarthy mysteriously moved to Southern California with Victoria, Tarantino's mother's best friend or something. The watering stopped. Some construction workers pulled up the pipeline and groundbreaking began for a large mansion right where the vegetable field would have been, which proves something about God's plan, because the divine force just can't know you have a problem unless you point it out to her or him or something like that. And sort of like the end of Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, where Toshiro Mifune looks around at the carnage and pontificates, "It looks like we survived," or something. Something like that, something simple, just like that. And you can learn a lot about human nature if you study Japanese cinema carefully and then apply it to your own life, which is what I am trying to do.
Good morning, everybody. I kind of thought about this a little bit after Glenn had approached me, and I think about, I look out in this room here, and for every person here, there's a definition of spirituality. All very different, all very personal. And we all express our spirituality there in our own way. Some sing, some do ceramics, some garden, some dance, some enjoy sports. We all express it in our own way. Some like to bake. I don't see that. I personally sometimes express my spirituality through my writing, poetry. And what I do is I write about what I see in the moment. I kind of freeze frame life, pull it out, look at it, write about it, and stuff it right back in. And I start off with my first poem is what I see when I walk to church every Sunday. And it's titled Church. Houses with sleepy windows. The hour is early. Chill gives rise to goosebumps. The pace quickens. Organic scent of fresh cut green grass smiles at the gardener. Fallen maple leaves color the sidewalk with shades of reds and yellows. Congregation of poppies line chipped cement. Choir birdsong echo the treetops. A mockingbird repeats what he hears. A wall of brick painted with green moss. Persimmons, orange as the burning sun, dangle on twisted branches like forgotten Christmas ornaments. Wayward droplets twinkle with the sunlight, lingering for the warmth to arrive. Sometimes my poetry also allows me to connect, special connections. And this one is called Walking with the Universe. At that exact moment, that single recalled minute in time, I realize I do not walk alone when walking with the universe. Attached to my organic surroundings, my path is filled not only with heartbeats of others, but also of leaf, rock, and soil. My steps rise and fall as the earth inhales and exhales the cosmos. And in the stillness between God and soul, I am stripped of self-importance. Fortunately, also my writings help me when I fall. I need to pick myself up. And this one is called Contemplation. Gutter sounds pounding. The rain demands to be let in. It's only the rhythmic drumbeat permeates the walls of solitude. Gray skies seep deep into my mind. One raindrop among thousands lingers, resisting the aquatic pull to descend. In that one small, tiny, minute crystal world, past hours, present minutes, and future dreams are thought upon. With a slight quiver, the leaf releases the tear. I reach out to catch the falling droplet. Fragments of liquid particles burst in my palm, exposing the false promise of encapsulated eternity. The dreamt hours, minutes, and dreams fall, absorbed back into the earth. But when warmed by the sun's penetrating touch, the drop will rise again. I also am very fortunate to have my poetry, my spirituality, allow me to bear witness to really remarkable moments when the universe shares its light. And this one is called Devotion. Lost in a withered mind, the ancient man no longer wills his feet to move. Standing upright, his arms hang limp, dead to his side. The young man attaches like a shadow, embracing the curved, brittle spine. From behind, intimate whispers encourage the blank stare to lift one foot and then the other. Arms are reminded to swing. Time is no importance. Distance is a matter of perception. The shadowy puppeteer launches forward. The old man launches forward. They walk as one. A brick stoop provides a place to rest. The old pup is molded to sit, arms gently positioned on his lap. The shadow breeze leans in slowly and places a light kiss on the wrinkled forehead. Space shared in the moment of time, steps shared in the moment of devotion. I have one more poem in closing, because I am really grateful for my spirituality, that I am able to be mindful, present, and joyful what's been placed before me. So I have one short poem, and it's actually one of my favorite, and it has no title. A lone cow's bray is heard in the distance. A single train whistle responds back. A woman stands with a solitary tree. The cow's call dissolves away. The train whistle departs. The woman remains with the tree, listening to the gift of birdsong. Thank you.
How to describe the process of writing. Well, you've already heard from some very talented writers. Thank you very much. I will try to explain it in my own way. It comes down to words, putting just the right words down in just the right order. It's pretty simple, right? Thusly, the wordage of your tellings will be quite readerly, and the relating of who's and what's resulting in the minds of them reading thusly shall be completely and impressively satisfied. Is punctuation important? Question mark, comma, open parentheses, you bet, all capitals, close parentheses, two exclamation marks, period. Or as Steve Martin says in one of his early comedy routines, either you have a way with words or, what was I going to say? I don't know. Not have way? I don't know. If you were going to ask me, how do I learn to write, I would give you the same advice I would give to someone who wants to learn to draw or paint or sculpt or act. I would advise you to just start doing it. If you want to draw, just start drawing. Sure, your first efforts might be crude stick figures, but you can build from there. If you want to paint, get some brushes and start to paint. If you want to sculpt, get some clay and start to shape it. If you want to write, go to your typewriter or computer or blank paper and start to write. Write down all of your ideas. Write down what happened to you yesterday. Start a journal. The next piece of advice towards creating any kind of art is to observe. Open your eyes and really look at the world around you. Really see the trees and the clouds and the houses and the people and the dogs and the cats and tables and chairs and bananas and microwave ovens and bicycles and discarded trash and cars and everything. And listen. Listen to the sounds of the wind and police sirens and birds and how people talk. Really, truly listen to the conversations you might have during the day and later write them down. Pay attention to people's inflections and accents and how they sometimes say the wrong things. When one is just starting with any art, it's okay to copy. If you want to act, copy your favorite actor's style. If you want to draw, trace some pictures of your favorite artist. If you want to write, imitate the style of a writer that you admire. It's okay. If you have talent, later on, you will develop your own style. You will find your own unique voice. For a writer, another necessary step is to read. Read everything you can get your hands on. Try different types of books. Fiction, nonfiction, short stories, biography, humor, science fiction, horror, historical fiction, and poetry. Then just write. Create a short story or a poem. Roses are red, violets are blue. I can write, and so can you. The process of writing for me starts with thinking. I go over the basic ideas of a piece over and over and over again in my head until it seems mostly right. Then when I go to put down the words, it's mostly there. But there is still a time of fine-tuning. Usually there are problems to work out, characters not quite defined, situations that don't quite make sense. These are the nuts that I have to crack. Sometimes the answers to these problems will come to me when I am out walking, or maybe in the shower, or maybe even in a dream. When that happens, and the solution to a problem is just there right in front of my eyes with perfect clarity, well, when that happens, it is the closest that I ever come to what some might call the divine. When I was a kid, one of the first things I learned to read were comic books. Actually, comics are written pretty well. I learned a lot of big words from just comics. Kids would look at me strangely as I began to increase my vocabulary and use words like repartee and bombastic in third grade. I also loved the usual children's books, especially Dr. Seuss. His words are just so much fun to read. The story I wrote for the kids recently, The Purple Piano Willamazoo, was shamelessly written in the Seussian style. But it's okay. It's okay for us amateurs to copy as we learn. I read all the Buster Brown mysteries. I read the Doc Savage adventure books. I read the science fiction of Edgar Rice Burroughs. And eventually I tried Wells and Matheson and Clark and Asimov and Poe and Shakespeare. In my life, I've probably spent more time with Stephen King, who you heard a quote from a little earlier, than any other author. Some literary snobs might call him the junk food of literature, but junk food is okay too. I really love a good hamburger and french fries from time to time. The first things I wrote were short nonsense rhymes at a very early age. My teachers encouraged this creativity. And for me, then writing also went hand in hand with drawing. I was creating my own little cartoons during class all the time. I would pass them around for the amusement of my classmates, and I would get positive reinforcement that way. Quite often they would feature the teachers in a comedic situation. I remember a math class in junior high. The teacher had this thick southern accent. That year I must have churned out about 100 cartoons featuring Captain Oaky. The class and even the teacher had fun with them. You could always tell which teachers were the cool ones in this way. The not-so-cool teachers would rip up the cartoon and send you to the principal. In high school, I and a couple of my pals were writing and drawing on these ongoing superhero comic series on these big pieces of paper on the school library wall. Kids would come by and read them and wonder what would happen next in the adventures of Captain Spriff. Later on, a not-so-cool kid tore it down and destroyed it. One thing a writer has to learn is to accept rejection. Of course, by this time, I also had a few fans among the school kids. They lit this bad kid's locker on fire. I'm not proud that they did that. I didn't encourage it, but at the time, it was somewhat satisfying. I did really well in English and creative writing in high school and later in college. As I mentioned before, earlier writing and drawing went hand in hand, and I continue to make amateur comic books to entertain my friends and myself. And I've drawn over 250 issues featuring Captain Spriff and his superhero pals. I have destroyed the Earth more than once. Later, writing and acting also went hand in hand. Several years ago, I was asked to create a mystery dinner play for this church and had great fun doing it. There have been several of these plays, some better than others. So now I'd like to share just a quick scene from one of these plays. For this play, I wanted to express something fun, but also to have the opportunity to throw in a little philosophy and maybe some religious ideas. So I thought I'd take a chance. I'd really go in some provocative directions. I wanted to entertain, but it's always good to make people think if you can. So this play was set in a mental institution located in Southern California. There were several unusual patients there, one who could speak only in Shakespearean verse, one who thought she was Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, and one who thought he was Jesus Christ himself returned to earth. Or was it just a delusion? I left it up to the audience to decide. In this scene, a new hospital administrator has just taken over running the hospital, and she was in the process of interviewing each of the patients, and she saved one particular patient for last. This is just a couple of pages from Believe It or Not, written in 2006. And again, this is a hospital administrator talking to a patient, kind of a skinny guy with a scraggly beard wearing a bathrobe and bunny slippers. So they sit down across from each other. Dr. Foster, who's the doctor, says, "Good afternoon. Please have a seat." And in the script, the gentleman is simply referred to as JC. JC says, "Good afternoon, Dr. Foster. How are you today?" "I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking. For the record, what is your name and place of birth?" "I was born Yahshua of Nazareth. You probably know me by the Roman translation, Jesus. As for the date, it kind of depends on what calendar you're looking at, I suppose." "So you claim to be the one and only Jesus Christ, the one in the New Testament of the Bible, the Son of God?" "I don't claim anything. I'm just who I am." "All right. When did you first realize you were Jesus Christ?" "My mother named me when I was born." "Uh-huh. And that was over 2,000 years ago?" "That's right." "I must say you're looking quite fit for your age." "Thank you. I try to eat right and exercise." "Tell me about your father." "Well, that's sort of a mystery. I've never actually seen him." "I see. Your father left you and your mother when you were a child. That must have been very traumatic for you." "He never actually left us. I still talk to him from time to time, but there have been a few times when I have felt abandoned, and yes, that can be traumatic." "So he still calls you? Where is he living?" That's another sort of a mystery. He's on what you might call another plane of existence." "Interesting. So you died, right, a long time ago, and then you came back, you rose from the dead. So why are you here now?" "Same as before, to spread the word that all men should live in peace as brothers." "But isn't your return supposed to precede the end of the world, disaster, floods, saving the chosen, faithful, and so forth?" "I don't know who started all that end-of-the-world nonsense. It certainly wasn't me. I just want all people to live in harmony." "So this isn't the so-called second coming?" "Oh, no, no, no. Let's see, I've been back 30 times now." "Oh, really? And why has no one been aware of these previous visits?" "Because, doctor, I have been jailed, institutionalized, ignored, or killed outright every single time." "Please tell me about it." "I've been coming back every 100 years or so. The first couple of times I was surprised to see that quite a few people were writing stories about my life. One time I encountered a scribe named Isaiah. I asked to read what he was working on. They were already starting to get things wrong, starting to exaggerate things. There were mistakes on dates, who said what to who, you know. And so, of course, I offered to help him." "Of course. What did he say?" "I don't recall his exact words, but it was something like, 'Buzz off and write your own book.'" He was worried that I might try to take credit from him. "That must have been quite frustrating." "It was. I wandered off into the desert until I died of thirst." "But you kept coming back." "If at first you don't succeed, try again." "Tell me more." "One time I came to Rome. There were many huge churches built in my name. There were representations of me everywhere, images of me done in stained glass, 30 feet high. I thought here at last would be people who would listen to me. I went into the largest church in the land and introduced myself. 'I am Jesus Christ, returned to earth. Listen to my words of love.' Man, I ended up in the dungeon so fast it would make your head spin. They called me a heretic and tortured me. They wanted me to confess that I was lying, and, well, I couldn't do that." "So they killed you?" "Eventually. Their inquisitors worked on me for days. They had more devices for cruelty and pain than you could possibly imagine. And all this was right below a church with images of me all over it. Finally, they broke my back on the rack. But surely you've seen some things in the world that have changed since then. Have they really? I've been coming to America the last couple of times. Once I walked up to this group of men. They seemed quite pleasant and happy. They were standing there drinking beer and laughing, and I thought, here are some simple, decent folks. These guys I could talk to. Well, in hindsight, I suppose I should have chosen my words more carefully. I walked up to them and said, I want to see all men loving each other. You should have seen the look of hatred they gave me. One of them called me a very rude name and whipped out a shotgun just like that, shot me, blew me right in half. Shortest resurrection ever. And how did you end up here? I was trying to be a little more careful this time, more quiet. I was wandering around back alleys talking to the poor, the homeless, the forgotten. The police picked me up as a vagrant. I told them who I was, and well, that's how I've ended up here. I've been here for 5 years now. So I won't go on with more of that. So, anyway, just to wrap this up, so I would advise you, if you like to write, keep writing. If you like to draw or paint or sculpt or garden or sew, keep doing those things. If you have no creative hobby, try one. If you don't like it, try something else. Creativity is good for the brain, and we need to exercise those mental muscles, or they will grow weak. And I love being in a room with lots of nice, healthy brains. May it be so.